This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done incredible things for the sake of our freedom, and we're going to hear from one of those young men today, now 92-year-old Ken Miller of Oakhurst, California. If you ever visit Yosemite, you're going to have to drive right through it as long as you're coming from the south. And he was a long way away from there during World War II. We're going to hear about some intense moments on Saipan and a couple other battles as well. But let's start, Mr. Miller, if we can. Growing up in Ohio, what was the big thing for a young man to do in Dover, Ohio?
Play sports in high school.
And Ohio's pretty famous for high school football. Were you football, a little basketball, what?
Basketball.
Did you have kind of a sports hero you looked up to or wanted to be like?
Yeah, Doc Kelker. Center, and he was excellent player. He went on to Cleveland and played with one of the colleges there.
Were you a big Cleveland Indians fan?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, Bob Feller and all the boys, yeah. Used to go there once in a while.
And you were already out of high school by the time that Pearl Harbor happened, I imagine.
Yeah, just a year.
What were your plans? What were your ambitions before the war started?
There wasn't any, not really a plan of doing anything other than working, making a living.
So then Pearl Harbor happens. Do you remember where you were that day and how you found out?
Can't remember exactly where I was, but somewhere in Dover.
Did you hear it on the radio?
I don't recall that.
But you were pretty motivated to do something about it, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely.
What do you think it was that made you want to go get involved?
The protection of our people and myself as well.
So you enlisted right away?
Yes. He sent me to San Diego.
What was the toughest thing for you to get used to? Because I imagine playing high school football and basketball is a little different than going through Marine Corps training.
Going through the boot camp is a difficult thing to do.
Tell me about it. What were the things that really made it difficult for you?
A sergeant trying to play God or two on your back and things like that, you know. Trying to drive discipline into your body so that you be able to handle what's coming up in the future in the field.
And at the time, it probably made you a little miserable?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Was there a time later where you felt like, you know what, maybe that was worth it? Maybe that did me some good?
That's right. That's when you look back and you say, well, they made it so that I would look at it in a different perspective as I would as a normal civilian coming on the job. You know.
What can you tell me about the guys that you served with and the relationships that you made with them?
They gave everything they could. Their lives, most of them. Eric Johnson was one of them. He was from up around Palo Alto. He was from there. And I named my son after him.
So you made some pretty good friends right off the bat in the Marine Corps?
Definitely.
And he was one of them?
Yes, that's true.
Tell me about him. What kind of guy was he?
He was a boxer. He'd allow me to box with him. And it was good for me because learned me a lot of things, what to do, not to do, and things like that.
Were you a pretty good boxer?
No.
So he got the better of you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. He knocked the pants off me. He kept going down.
When you think back on that time training to go overseas, what do you think prepared you the best or had the biggest impact on what you would experience down the road?
Everything that we did was for a purpose. And each and every one of them may be a little more difficult than the other, and on and on and on and on. Training was excellent.
Now, I imagine you were one of the taller Marines around. Did you get a nickname for that?
No, Slim.
Do you remember when you found out you were heading overseas and what that felt like to ship out?
Well, it was pretty sad because I was leaving my wife at that time then in California. We were in California, and we left out of San Diego.
So you're leaving behind a wife. Did you think you were ever going to see her again?
Yeah. No, I wasn't going to die. Nah, I wasn't going to die. I watched John Wayne movies.
Did you know at the time that she was expecting?
No, I didn't know that for a while.
Had you ever been on the ocean before?
Not to this extent.
What was that like for you? Did you get used to it in a hurry?
No, you're sort of surprised for the depth that they have for the ocean itself, you know. Nothing but water, water, and water.
Until you got to New Zealand, I guess, right?
And then we came back from New Zealand, of course, and we went to Tarawa.
And that was a bloody, bloody battle. How did you experience it? Tell me how that went down.
I didn't have it as difficult as those that first went on the shore or first line, you know. But they found things for us to get involved with, such as burying the dead Japanese and what have you, and out of the piers that they were in. It's concrete. That was difficult because we was using a number four wire. We tied those around each of the ankles and drug them out after we threw in a hand grenade in order to make sure there was no enemy waiting for us at the bottom of the hill.
So you were kind of mopping up at Tarawa?
Absolutely. They needed people to explore each and every one of the bunkers, go to it professionally by throwing grenades into the bunker to make sure that nobody's alive. So when you go down into the bunker, that your life is at stake. And we worked in teams of two. So from there, why we went on to other things, back to Hawaii for about 4 or 5 months, training again, and then off to Saipan, Tin Yan.
So, but if you're mopping up, you're seeing some of the effects of what happened there. And I've seen photos, and it's not just dead Japanese, dead Americans in the surf, and the surf was red. Can you describe for us what you saw as you approached that little strip of land?
Well, you couldn't believe what you were seeing, looking and seeing the bodies floating and here and there, and then we collect them and, of course, then give them the proper burial.
Did that take an emotional toll on you?
Very difficult. Very difficult.
What do you think got you through that? Helped you? Because I imagine that's a stomach-turning duty, and it's not anything you look forward to. What do you think it was that helped you endure and survive?
I just looked up and told him I needed help. And stay with me. And he did.
Amen. What kind of impact did that have on your outlook after seeing what you saw there, seeing what war is like, experiencing the death, the carnage, the devastation, and knowing that this wasn't the end of it for you? What kind of impact did that have?
That life wasn't too precious. It was easy slipping by on some of those that I watched being buried at sea and aboard a ship. And it's difficult to talk about it. But anyway.
Did you ever hear from your wife? Did you get any letters from home?
That was not until we hit Saipan. When we hit Saipan, I think it was June 16th. Once you hear that you got a daughter, and by the way, I didn't see her until she was 18 months old when I got home back in Ohio. So there's a lot of dirt flying here.
You've been part of one battle. You're getting ready for another one, and you get a letter from home saying, hey, you're a father. You have a baby girl. I can't imagine what that felt like. Do you remember what that was like?
Ah!
Made you feel like a man, huh?
Yeah, I was really pleased, very pleased. I always have been.
Was there part of you that wondered if you'd ever get to meet her, if you were going to make it home to see her?
Well, the thought had passed through your mind, you know, and you just hope that God's looking out for you and has the right answers, and he did.
And you described what you did at Tarawa and how you guys were mopping up. You get to one of those Japanese bunkers, you throw a grenade in and just to make sure, and then you have to clean it up. Were you prepared for what you encountered at Saipan? Did you see any of that coming?
No way. No way.
Maybe some folks listening have read a little bit about that battle, or maybe they've read about what happened to a lot of civilians there jumping off the cliff. Maybe they know a little bit. But what can you tell us about what you experienced on Saipan?
You have to prepare each day so that you know what might happen, never knowing what will happen as if the attack on us. The attack came from, they got pinned down at the end of the island, which means they go into the ocean. So they didn't go into the ocean. There was over 3,000, and they came at us with anything and everything they had. It starts about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and they bring on their whatever they have. They bring the tanks, what tanks they had, and anything they had, and come at us.
You had about 300 men?
Yeah, about 300 to 500, I'd say. I don't know. I didn't count them. From there on, we just kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. I got wounded that morning about 5 in the morning, 5:30, something like that. Left leg, thigh, And the corpsman came and helped me, fix me up and what have you. And so I got going again. And I could still walk and run somewhat, hobble somewhat. But later that day, I saw him in the pile of death. And he was one of the persons that was dead.
The corpsman was?
Robertson was his name. And he was a corpsman. Eric Johnson also, which is who I named my son after, but he was dead. The sergeant also in charge of that particular area, why, he was dead.
Well, there were a lot more dead than there were living from what I've read about it. Did you guys have any indication, any warning that this bonsai charge was going to happen?
Absolutely not. We have people in the field, they reported to us what's happening. There's certain activity going on and what have you, and it just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. Like over 3,000 came on us, and we did what we could.
So you're outnumbered 10 to 1?
10 to 1. So that'd be about right. Also, the enemy, of course, shooting or wounding our people. Anyway, we had to make a barrier for those people to be in so we could protect them from the people that's coming back towards us again still. And so we in turn had to do the best job we could, and which we did. We held them off until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 or 4, and finally the American tanks came in and helped us. And but we were shooting from person to person, hand to hand.
So for 9-10 hours, it's just you guys with your, what, machine guns, BARs?
Pistols. I used their weapons as well, rifles and stuff. And
took it from dead Japanese and fired them back at them?
Yeah, whatever I could use.
I know it's not easy to talk about or even think about those times, but I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes. And if we're outnumbered 10 to 1, I think I'm probably thinking that I'm not going to see tomorrow. I'm never going to meet that daughter I heard about. What went through your mind in that situation?
Get them water. They need water. They need water. Our troops need water. Our wounded need water. So we went back through the lines and got water and brought 5-gallon water cans and brought it. And that article was written up in the Life magazine, one of those.
Was the enemy fire constant? Was it nonstop this whole time?
It's as consistent as I ever wanted to see it.
So everything you do, you're risking being hit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you go back through the enemy line, get what you can get, and get out of there.
Well, I don't think I'm alone in wondering how in the world you survived that kind of desperate and chaotic situation. But we're going to explore some more of that after the break. Our guest is 92-year-old Marine Corps veteran Ken Miller of Oakhurst, California. You can find some photos of Ken at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Also on that Facebook page, a video from Ken's trip to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight and the big surprise that he received during a special lunch at the Library of Congress. We're actually going to listen to some of that surprise when we come back, but you can see the emotion on his face by pulling up that video again on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Right back with the rest of Ken's story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.